Welcome to episode 7 of the Leverage Podcast from the Bailey Group. Each Leverage Podcast features exceptional CEOs and entrepreneurs who have been successful navigating their organizations through transformational change. I'm Lee Bailey, founder and CEO of the Bailey Group, and today I'm talking with Stephanie Schimpf and David Burley, owners of Blue Plate Restaurant Company. Founded in 1993 with the launch of the Highland Grill in St. Paul, Blue Plate now operates 8 full-service restaurants in the Twin Cities, plus their newest venture, the Blue Barn at the Minnesota State Fair, which opened in 2014. The food service industry plays an important role in the nation's economy. According to the National Restaurant Association, sales are expected to hit a record high of $709 billion this year. The restaurant industry is also the second largest private sector employer, with a workforce of 14 million. But the industry is not without its challenges. Minnesota is projected to be among the nation's lowest for sales growth, and restaurateurs across the state are experiencing a shortage of workers. Today we'll hear about Stephanie and David's successful business model and how they've been able to keep their restaurants relevant amidst industry disruption and constant change. Welcome, Stephanie and David.
Good morning.
Thank you again.
Hi.
So, let me start with Stephanie. I understand that at age 22, you sold your car to help finance the Highland Grill. Tell me about your decision to take the leap into entrepreneurship and the launch of Blue Plate Restaurant Company with David.
Thankfully, I didn't really know what I was getting into. I think at 22, that was a huge benefit. But I grew up in an economic situation in my childhood where I think it enabled me to take a risk. I really didn't have much to lose. So I met David. We were waiting tables. And, you know, of course, when you're in your teens or early 20s, you think you know everything. And, and I don't think we were any exception to that rule. We did see a shortage in the market of breakfast restaurants. So I think we did have a little bit of vision in that respect. But we thought, hey, we could do this. This would be fun. We're doing it now for someone else. Why not try it ourselves? And the insertion of cash was quite small. I think it was under $10,000.
Yeah.
Plus or minus. So, you know, about half a car's worth. And we really thought, we have nothing to lose. Let's do it.
So, David, if Stephanie sold a car, what's your story about the decision to leap into being an entrepreneur?
Tips. Yeah, I saved my money from waiting tables at a restaurant in Minneapolis. And between the two of us, we had enough to scrape together to get this thing started.
The accent was worth an extra 30 or 40% in tips, you know, compared to what I made in tips.
It's gone away a little bit now, but yeah, it was a little bit thicker 20 years ago. So
David, Blue Plate has grown into a $30 million operation over the last 22 years. As the leaders of the company, you and Stephanie have been successful in identifying your individual strengths and determining roles and clarifying roles with each other. So tell me how you've gone about doing that and what your roles are today.
There's actually quite a bit of overlap, but our roles have they have somewhat evolved. I was always the leader, but that's kind of it's still I mean still technically that's it. But we share a lot of the vision stuff together now. We do a lot of the creative stuff together. Steph does more of the marketing side of it. I'm a little more nuts and bolts.
So what does it mean to be the leader? When you say you were the leader, what does that mean?
Holding the team accountable, keeping them all going in the same direction, motivating them to the degree that I need to, and just being kind of that constant driver.
Mm-hmm. Constant even pressure.
That too.
You're definitely more of the visionary. I think between the two of us, I think we both know that you can see out 5 years more clearly than I can, and trends.
Somewhat,
yeah. So, Stephanie, what would you say are the primary talents that you've brought to the business?
I think I'm more of the relationship person. maybe the therapist in the group. And I think the hospitality piece as well.
Hmm.
Although we know David's quite, you know, back in our days of, we both have a, I think, remarkable drive and ambition to do well by our guests and our employees. You know, mm-hmm. we both come from a find a way to say yes culture and get the job done.
Hmm. We have a lot of empathy for our employees. I mean, both of us have done pretty much every job in the house now, with the exception of brewing.
Mm-hmm.
But so that gives us a little bit of a window into what our team's experiencing, whether they be a chef or a server or a manager or a bartender. We mm-hmm. we can assimilate to what they're doing, what they're going through.
We've done, I don't think I could have my own TV series, but I've done a lot of dirty jobs, you know, and I think David could, I can think of one in particular that, you know, we've both done a lot of dirty jobs, and mm-hmm. so there really isn't anything that I could ask one of our staff members to do that I haven't done.
Mm-hmm. Neither of us were really strangers to hard work,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know that I'd recommend this formula for others, but we just, when we started, we just kind of muscled our way through the first. We didn't have a hell of a strong business plan. Our business plan was to open a breakfast joint and just work it. And mm-hmm. So that's what we did. I don't think we took a day off for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And we just kind of just worked
mm-hmm.
and did everything that was needed to be done. We sort of split the accounting functions. I was the cook and Steph was the server, and we both split dishwashing assignments, and we were also working at night for a competitor to pay the rent.
Yeah, I think we continued to work for.
Yeah, we worked for
D'Amico for about 18 months.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Until we could get a day off and move on.
So you both have referenced that you come from backgrounds or experiences that have both made you willing to take risks, if you will, mm-hmm. and also it sounds like you both develop work ethics that say doesn't matter that we're owners or whatever, we do whatever it takes to be. Would you mind just sharing a little bit about what your backgrounds were, kind of where you come from?
I was born and raised in Western Australia. We moved around quite a bit. I went to several schools, and then joined the army, and that brought me to the United States, and I fell in love with America. And then when I resigned from the military, I there weren't a lot of openings for trained killers, so I went into the restaurant business.
Hmm.
Yeah,
I'm imagining the job description: serve tables, mm-hmm. requirements, train killer.
The shooting kangaroos thing didn't come in handy.
I shot kangaroos for a little while before I joined the army.
We both drove trucks for a while.
Yeah, we both drove trucks. She mm-hmm. drove a dump truck. I actually drove a newspaper truck that was the longest paper run in the world.
So Stephanie, you drove a dump truck. How does that happen?
I think that's part of that. You know, don't dare me anything. Let's not play truth or dare, because the whole dare thing was kind of how the dump truck piece happened. But I was waiting tables, cocktail waitressing in Lake City, where I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And this gentleman who would sit at the bar, who owned an excavating company, came in. And that summer, the farmer's elevator inadvertently switched a load of atrazine, which is a herbicide, you know, kills everything, and fertilizer. The fertilizer was supposed to go to the farmer, the fertilizer to the golf course, and the atrazine to the farmer. And the atrazine went to the golf course and killed all of the fairways. Anyway, he needed, in short order, a fleet of additional dump truck and heavy equipment operators, and he came in and he was talking about it, and I'm like, gosh, that sounds fun. What's it pay? You know, and I'm like, I'd do that. So mm-hmm. I came to the cities, as we called it. When you live in the outstate, you grew up saying the cities. And I came to the cities and did my truck driver course, the kind mm-hmm. that you see advertised on TV late at night. kicked some tires, got my license, and ended up driving a truck for a couple of summers. And it did pay well, and I learned to drink beer.
I love the language. I was driving truck.
Yeah.
There's just something powerful about that.
But I think that was that spirit of, well, I could do this. Mm-hmm. You know, I could do this. And I think that's how part of what led to the restaurant piece as well. I've done this.
Mm-hmm. So, Stephanie, Americans are moving away from fast food and continue to embrace fast casual dining like Chipotle and Panera. Blue Plate seems to have created its own niche that's somewhere sort of between fine dining and casual dining. I have to say, I think being in the industry that you're in and trying to figure out how do we find a niche and how do we stay with our clientele as their needs and desires change, how have you adapted your business model over time to address the changing desires of consumers?
You know, we've always been the neighborhood place, and I think we'll continue to be the neighborhood place. We've, over the years, adapted our menus to, you know, portions went up, then portions kind of rolled back a little bit. Healthier items, you know, we're constantly evolving. I think one of our strengths, certainly coming from David, is we don't sit on our hands. We are always in an evolutionary state. Mm-hmm. You know, not change for the sake of change, but improvement and innovation. So a lot of it comes with, you know, the menu piece. And then the other big thing would be we're not afraid to rip the Band-Aid off and refresh. Hmm. We just did a major, you know, $300,000 investment on our Highland Grill, which is 23 years old or opened in 1993. And, you know, some would say, well, why would you change it? And for us...
Some did say.
Yeah, some did say. Mm-hmm. But we did. We turned it upside down, redid the menu, and changed the decor and updated.
So how come? How come you decided to make that transformation?
You know, part of it's physical plant. I mean, it'd been 14 years since our previous renovation. The life cycle of our other restaurants seems to be about 7 or 8 years before they need a physical capital improvement. Mm-hmm. But the neighborhood is changing. You know, we want to meet the needs of the younger families, the baby boomers, you know, the millennials, the healthier food, and just... We don't want to become the legacy restaurant.
Restaurants have a shelf life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are very few restaurants that can stick around without updating. You can name half a dozen restaurants in the Twin Cities that have been able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
They're mostly high end restaurants. A couple of sort of, you know, there's some that fly under the radar, but by and large, if you don't reinvent your store and concept and feel and vibe and food and the whole package, you will continue to keep your regulars, but you won't attract new guests. And if you don't attract new guests, you're slowly dying because people do move. They move away and change their habits and whatnot.
And when we first came into the restaurant business in 1993, I don't want to say that we created a category, but there were few players in our category of breakfast, lunch, dinner. And then with the addition of cocktails. But now there are lots and lots of neighborhood restaurants with casual dining focus. So, you know, we have to almost keep up with ourselves.
Mm-hmm. So, David, Stephanie described you, and you sort of described yourself as the visionary of the organization, a little bit anyway. I'm curious, so what do you monitor? What is the process for you that... reaches the conclusion that, gee, maybe we need to, it's time to, because the neighborhood has changed or whatever. What is it that you're monitoring that drives the awareness that it's time to make a change or transform?
We have some pretty sophisticated financial models in the organization today, and that can be a great guide. But honestly, I think both of us, it's just our gut. And we walk into a store, you can tell in a few seconds whether or not this is going to be a great experience in your dining room. You can just look around and see whether people are having a good time, whether the service is great, whether the food is good, whether the timing's good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same thing applies at a 30,000 foot view. When we look at a neighborhood and I look at one of my restaurants and I'm like, how are we positioned in this market? What's the competition doing? What should we be doing? What are they doing on the East Coast? What are they doing on the West Coast? I pay careful attention to what's happening in Chicago and watch what the trends are there. We've always been able to sort of pull some ideas from other bigger markets, more competitive markets, and we have to tweak slightly what we do.
Minnesotification
of food. We have to continue to do that and bring new ideas. So we push the food, we push the concepts, the music, the lighting, everything has got to be spot on. And then once it starts to get tired, you feel it. You feel it. I mean, the sales is a lagging indicator. So we watch what our guests are telling us, how it feels. Because if your restaurant if your sales start to slip, you had a problem 6 months ago. It's not the problem you have today. Yeah.
So Stephanie, you said that you're sort of the therapist of the organization. I wonder if that relates to helping employees through the changes that you initiate in the restaurants, or what does it mean to be the therapist?
I think that's part of it. I just tend to be the relationship person, the relator. Approachable, listening,
woo.
Yes, I we all believe it. We believe in the
strengths finder,
right? I'm woo, which is winning others over. All of my core competencies tend to fall in that relational piece, which is really interesting for us to do. And David's, much more strategic and visionary, which makes us a really good team.
Mm-hmm.
We have our moments where we disagree, sometimes quietly, sometimes loudly, and it really works.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, just having those, whether it be a one-on-one with a, manager or server, or it be, we've done kind of employee roundtables or focus groups with our staff.
So one of the things that's interesting, I had a conversation with an entrepreneur not very long ago, and we were talking about his relationship with his partner, and we talked about complementarity is a really good thing, that one has one strength, one has another strength, and that can be a really complementary thing. And then there are times when that complementarity can be challenging as well, in terms of trying to find ways to make sure that you can each see each other's perspective around business issues, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
How have you managed that over the years?
Carefully.
Mm-hmm.
No, we've been, how long have we been doing this? 23 years.
And so
it hasn't always been as good as it is now.
Mm-hmm.
Like we didn't have clearly defined, even vaguely defined roles and responsibilities. And now I think it's just trust. Like I trust Steph implicitly to make decisions on what she's on anything, and I feel that I have the same that same reciprocity. So.
That seems really important. If you can believe in the other person's intent and competence,
you
can let go of some of those things and just assume that they're going to do the right thing.
Yep.
Yeah.
The same trust applies to our team as well, our executive team and our general managers. I mean, we've gotten good at letting go, I think especially in the last 5-10 years, where we can trust out. We've been able to hire and recruit and attract some strong people, and we've been able to just point them in the right direction and give them the bowling bumpers,
Exactly. Right.
And the more you carve out that responsibility and role, I think the easier it gets.
Mm-hmm.
I think when we had the most issues in our partnership dynamic was when we had overlap, too much overlap.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And now that we really understand what our role is for ourselves and for each other, it's made it a lot easier.
Seems really important. So the more clear you are about this is mine and this is yours, the easier it is to navigate those differences and to benefit from the complementarity.
And it's a lot easier on our team and our staff as well. I mean, there was this time years ago when there was this kind of this saying in our organization, "Our mom and dad are fighting again." so we don't do that as much anymore.
So, David, let me ask you a little bit about the Twin Cities restaurant industry. As I mentioned earlier, the Twin Cities restaurant industry is in the midst of disruption. I understand there's a shortage of chefs and food service workers, which has resulted in some restaurants cutting hours and others having to close their doors. So how do you approach risk management, and what do you do at Blue Plate to deal with some of those disruptions?
We haven't solved that. That's still a work in process. We're still dealing with honestly the worst shortage of labor that I can recall.
I think it's worse than the 90s,
well,
though.
Yeah, 98. Mm-hmm. There was a crunch where we couldn't find people, but we only had a couple of restaurants, so it wasn't that critical. Now it's
amplified for sure.
But we're looking at our benefits. We're looking at our salaries. We're looking at our even concept wise, like what are we going to, like my, as we alluded to, my job is to figure out what we're going to do next. And we actually had a pretty strong idea of what we were going to do, and we've had to pause and really think hard about what we're going to do. Should we be doing restaurants that don't rely upon labor quite so much? It's a question we still haven't answered.
It's interesting. We work in other industries where employing people at, and I would just say, the lower end of the wage scale, if you will, mm-hmm. and the difficulty of attracting and then retaining when it's easy for a Walmart to mm-hmm. raise their wages, and then there's a more attractive wage package someplace else. That must be a real challenge, trying to attract and retain the quality mm-hmm. of workers that you want.
Yeah, I mean, we've always prided ourselves as being an employer of choice. I mean, we offer health insurance. We've offered 401k
since the 90s.
Since we first learned what it was. We celebrate our employees' tenure. We give, we've gotten some notoriety for handing out.
I heard that Rolex watches after 10 years.
Yeah, we give out.
Wow.
It was a few years ago. We were talking about how important essentially our servers are our sales force. And when you think about how important your sales force is to any mm-hmm. organization, if they stick around for 10 years, and if you do the math on that, essentially consider that. Your restaurant years are like dog years, so it's like if you can stick around for 10 years, you've given us essentially a lifetime. And so, what better way to recognize that than to mm-hmm. so?
What a neat concept!
It's gotten us pretty friendly with our local jewelers too.
Mm-hmm. And yoga, that was one of your ideas too. That we our industry isn't well known for wellness. Mm-hmm. I think over the years, hospitality workers drink, smoke, and we're on our feet. And, David brought the idea of doing, our own wellness program with yoga. So twice a week we pay for an instructor to come in to at the restaurant and we offer a yoga class.
It's gotten successful now that we modified it to yoga and a pint.
So. So how do you, I just have to say, how do you do that when you I assume you have crossing shifts and that sort of mm-hmm. thing? So do you run it several times during
the day?
Yeah, we do
different days of the week, different times. So we have some for our AM workers, some for our PM workers.
I'm loving the yoga and pint. That's a great concept.
It worked out. That was your idea.
Attendance did increase after we added the pint.
Free beer.
Mm-hmm. So, Stephanie, last year... Blue Plate reversed what was a somewhat controversial decision to reduce employees' tips to make up for the state's minimum wage hike. Instead, you increased non-tipped employees' pay. So it made me wonder about governance and how governance works at Blue Plate. Do you have an advisory board? Do you have a governing board? How does governance work? And how do you make decisions like that? Big sort of strategic visible decisions?
We don't have a formal board, but we do have an informal kind of group of trusted advisors that we speak to. We've talked about forming an advisory board. Mm-hmm. I could see that topic coming up again in the next few years. We have also added in the last 2 years a true executive level beyond just the two of us. So we have a CFO who comes to us with experience in, you know, many other industries. In fact, he'd never worked in the restaurant industry before. Along with our, we added a chief operating officer maybe 15 months ago, and he too came from a corollary industry, a food industry, mm-hmm. distribution, but had never worked in a restaurant ever. So, you know, with the addition of those two C-level players, I think we have the ability to bounce ideas off of one another and make those decisions now. And then, of course, we have, you know, our lawyer, CPA, and those sorts of
So it sounds like the two of you are co-CEOs then? Is that sort of how that works?
More or less.
I'm seeing a scrunchy face, not so much.
We haven't really gotten our arms around the titles just yet. I mean, we're still sort of
sorting them. I just heard CFO, COO, yeah. and that leaves a...
I'm CEO, and technically she's president, but it's pretty loose at our level, pretty mm-hmm. loose at the table.
So would you be willing to share a little bit just about... I was looking at a posting on Facebook about how people reacted to the decision around tips and that sort of thing. How did that process go, and how did you make the initial decision? How did you change that decision? What was that like?
It's quite awful.
It was excruciating.
Hmm.
We've always been really open and honest with our staff. We've been really
transparent.
Yeah, we share. We've just been really transparent, and we spoke to a few of our staff about. We didn't speak to the entire organization. But we spoke to some of our staff about this thing. The minimum wage was going up. We were looking at ways to offset that. So we timed doing this with the day that the minimum wage went up, and mm-hmm. A couple of employees were disgruntled about it. They leaked it to the newspaper. The newspaper was looking for a story on minimum wage, and one thing led to another, and we became the poster child for all things evil with the mm-hmm. with the business with business. We truly went viral.
It was probably the most emotional, if nothing else, the most emotional business
it got kind of
trial.
Personal.
Yeah, and we had death threats. You know, emails
wow.
that
I
people.
Hope your house burns down. I hope your kids are in it. I mean, it was like, wow, really?
Wow,
it's really intense.
Yeah,
especially for us, because we've really prided ourselves on taking care of our employees and being really, you know, trustworthy and honest. We don't. Mm-hmm. We don't do anything even slightly deceitful. I mean, it was a real blow. Was it, like Steph said, it was an emotional
blow.
Must
have been personally.
Oh,
yeah.
It was painful.
Yeah. Very.
It was. So we wrote it out for
a week or so, 10 days,
and then we were like, well, we got to do something. We called a press release, a press conference, and we reversed it and raised our wages. In fact.
It's tough, though, because there are many national players do this. Many yeah. other independents in town do this. It's not it's not uncommon.
Hmm.
You know, for instance, you know, I just got my hair cut last week. I can pay for my haircut service with a credit card, but I can't leave a tip on the credit card. That's the same principle.
Hmm.
We were just saying, hey, you know, and the reason the hairdresser, the salon, does this. You know, mm-hmm. it's not something we were inventing, but we really were the target for it.
Yeah, we were on the front. We were on the homepage of, I think, 30 or 40 union websites across the country, with a target on our backs. So it was a.
How do you think it changed you? To what degree? Just as
made us very. Very careful about what we engage with in a political environment, because
mm-hmm.
we have to truly think through. And really, a friend of mine is a friendly competitor of mine, and she said, "Boy, welcome to our world." And they're a bigger player than we are, but we'd always sort of, I wouldn't say flown under the radar, but we were always somewhat of a small business. And when this happened, I think that was a sort of a catapult from being a small business to a bigger small business.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Were you going to say something?
I think, you know, if we could do something like this again, I certainly would. I think I'd increase the level of communication with our staff, you know, town hall meetings, or, you know, more input, create greater awareness, you know, to certainly help people understand what our intentions are. But, you know, it's really made us shy, reticent to make big changes like that again.
Understandably so.
Yes.
Burned once.
Yes.
So, on a more positive note, David, Blue Plate prides itself on giving back to the community. This month you're inviting patrons, and I saw this at Edina Grill, that you're inviting patrons to make a donation to People Serving People.
Yep.
And you pledged to match up to $10,000.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about how philanthropy has been part of your business model over the years.
We've gotten better at it as we've gotten bigger. It's still the same concept. We still give to those organizations that are local and that we can see that are in our sort of field of operation, so to speak. So we try to give to. We actually designed this. Well, the People Serving People thing is a company wide push. We discovered this organization a couple of years ago, and what they do, if you're not aware, they give families. Complete families a place to stay for 3 months, and ship all these kids to the schools that they go to without disrupting their when they find themselves without a home. They feed them, ship them to the schools, and help them get jobs and whatnot. It's just an amazing organization. They're located downtown Minneapolis. So as soon as we discovered it, we were like, we gotta get it. We gotta be a part of this. So last year we did it. We raised, I think, around $23,000.
Yeah, just over $20,000.
Yeah,
wow.
And we're our goal this year is to push that a little further. Mm-hmm. And then we also developed this. We also at a much more organic and local level, we have this digital contraption called the Feel Good Machine, where diners get a chip. We take applications for five different charities.
Is that what that?
Yeah,
that there were those three.
Yes.
We were talking about what are those?
Yeah,
tubes?
If you walk up to the machine, the screen activates and it's a sort of a screensaver telling you what these five organizations are, and you vote with your dining dollar essentially, and we make a donation to that at the end of the month. We give a donation to the winning association, and it can be, you know, Friends of the Mississippi River. It could be, you know, the local dog park. It could be some local kindergarten. It's whatever, whoever submits applications. And we're not talking about tons of money here. I mean, you know, it's, you know, $500, $1,000, a couple thousand dollars.
Of the smaller organizations.
But some small organizations. It's a there's, you know, Boy Scout troops and whatnot. It's pretty cool. So, yeah.
So it sounds like that's something you wanted to do all along, but you've reached the point now where you can really do that in a more intentional way.
Yeah, we've always been really generous with philanthropy, but it's been smaller. I mean, it's just been smaller, and now we get to actually, now that we're we're still, you know, 8 unique little restaurants, but collectively we have a little more power. So we can, if we point our dining dollars in the right direction, we can actually make an impact. It's pretty neat.
I think because we both came from very humble beginnings too, it's not so much a duty but an honor for us to be able to do this. Mm-hmm. You know, I was a free hot lunch kid and food stamps, and I know that my gifts at holiday time came from the local civic clubs like the Kiwanis clubs and such. This is just how we're wired.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kids and hunger, I think, are two very important pieces to us. In the beginning, we did lots of in-kind donations because we didn't have any. Yeah, lots of cheese and meat trays. We didn't have money to give, but now we're in a better place, and we can actually make you know, cash donations like we're doing for people serving people.
Very cool. So, Stephanie, what's the future of Blue Plate?
Hopefully,
what you can devolve.
Yeah, continued prosperity and, you know, investment in our communities, investment in our employees and our company. You know, we're too young to retire and certainly too antsy and ambitious. I think that we'll continue to carefully grow Blue Plate and invest in our local communities.
As we progress through this, the importance of our people has really come to the fore. And so the development piece, the development, the training, the reinvesting in our team and the kids, as we call them, because a lot of our staff are a lot younger than we are now. So we're investing in the kids and making sure that they're getting everything. They're not just here for a paycheck. They're here for. We don't expect all of them to stay with us forever, but certainly learning how to be a member of the community.
Intern development program. You know, we're working with a couple of different colleges and universities now to develop a true internship program. I'd love to see that. You know, within the next, you know, by the end of say 2017, have a thriving intern program in place.
There's this theme that I hear amongst executive leaders like yourself that at some point it comes back to how do we engage and inspire the folks who are doing the work on a day, that becomes sort of the primary task that you have of leading the business.
Yeah, and we've been fortunate. We've had many, many employees over the years leave and do what we did, and we celebrate when they do that. There's many restaurateurs around town that came that worked alongside of us, worked for us. And they take a little bit with them, and it's awesome. That's what we did. Same thing.
Well, David and Stephanie, thank you very much for sharing your unique leadership perspective for the Bailey Group's Leverage Podcast today. We really appreciate your time and your words of wisdom. Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.